You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
I want to thank everybody for coming out to discuss Ernie Drucker's new book, A Plague of Prisons. My name is Jill Harris. I'm the acting deputy director of the Drug Policy Alliance, and I'll be moderating this evening. So how we're going to proceed, I'm going to introduce these three gentlemen to my right, and then each of them will speak in turn. I think Ethan will go first, then Judge Sweet, and finally the man of the hour, Dr. Drucker. So I'll start by introducing Ethan, who's my boss, actually, at the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan Nadelman's the founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, the leading organization in the United States advocating for drug policies grounded in science, compassion, health, and human rights. He was born in New York City. He received his BA, his JD, and his PhD from Harvard University, as well as a master's degree in international relations from the London School of Economics. He taught politics and public affairs at Princeton University for a number of years, and he authored two books on international criminal law enforcement, as well as dozens of articles on drug policy and many publications such as Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy Science, National Review, and The Nation. He's also been a commentator, a speaker, a debater on just about every show you can think of, from the Colbert Report to Nightline to the O'Reilly Factor to Crossfire. He's been on every network, including Al Jazeera. And is really just out there speaking all the time on drug policy reform. Rolling Stone describes him as the point man for drug policy reform efforts, and it's true that he's the leading advocate for drug policy reform, both in the United States and internationally. So we'll be looking forward to hearing from him and hearing his thoughts on Dr. Drucker's book. Judge Sweet is a senior judge in the U.S. District Court in the Southern District of New York. He was appointed by President Carter in 1978 and became senior status in 1991. In addition to serving as a judge, he's been active in the international arena. He's traveled all over the world, places like Albania, China, Indonesia, Poland, and Iraq, in connection with the rule of law program sponsored by U.S. Information Agency. He has published a number of law review articles related to the challenges facing judges and the role of justice in society, including the judge's dilemma, duty or conscience, and also an article called Will Money Talk? The Case for a Comprehensive Cost-Benefit Analysis on the War on Drugs. Judge Sweet graduated from Yale University, Yale Law School. He served in the Navy during World War II. He also served in the U.S. Attorney's Office and was a deputy mayor of New York City under Mayor Lindsay. He was a partner at Skadden, Arp, Slate, Mager, and Flom from 1970 until he was appointed to the bench. And over the years, he's used his position of authority and respect to speak out on the need for drug policy reform and on the failure of our current system, and we owe him a debt of gratitude for doing that. And then finally, Dr. Drucker is a professor emeritus in the Department of Family and Social Medicine at Montefiore Medical Center, Albert Einstein College of Medicine. He's an adjunct professor of epidemiology at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. He's a senior research associate and scholar in residence at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. And he's on the teaching faculty of the Bard Prison Initiative. He's also a licensed clinical psychologist in New York State, and he conducts research on AIDS, drug policy, and prisons. And he's active in public health and human rights efforts in the United States and abroad. He was the director of the Division of Public Health and Policy Research at Montefiore Einstein for 25 years. And in that capacity, he founded Montefiore's 1,000-patient drug treatment program in 1970. And he served as its director until 1990. For those of you who remember the AIDS crisis, that was right when it hit, and he was right in the thick of it and was a hero to many of us who were involved in the AIDS activist movement. He's the author of over 100 peer-reviewed scientific articles, texts, and book chapters. He's the founder and a life member of the International Harm Reduction Association. He's a founder and chairman of the board of Doctors of the World. He's been a fellow at the Linda Smith Center and the Open Society Institute, a senior Soros Justice Fellow, and a 2010-2011 senior specialist in global health at the U.S.-Australian Fulbright Program at the Law School of New South Wales. We're here to honor him and to celebrate the publishing of his new book, A Plague of Prisons, The Epidemiology of Mass Incarceration in America, which is published this year by the New Press. So I think Ethan may add some color commentary on both of the two gentlemen that I introduced, so I'll turn it over to him.
Well, I think Judge Sweet's going to go first, speak first, so I'll wait for that. And
we start with good looks.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you, Ernie. Well put.
You know, it gives you an uncomfortable feeling to know that you're going to be followed by Ethan. Let me say that I really am delighted for this chance to be with all of you, and particularly with Ernie and Ethan. Ernie is a truly extraordinary person. He's a thinker, and he's a doer. He's a comrade in the battle for a good and an open society. He is, in my view, the infinite onion. You peel one layer, and by George, then there's another, and another, and another. He is consistent. He has been consistent throughout his life, and he has extraordinary courage. He's spent his life in various ways trying to make this world a better place. He's done it by tackling some of the most intractable problems that we have in our society, drugs, AIDS, and now he's tackled the issue basically of justice. I think when you read the book, perhaps to me is one of the most moving parts of it. The book is structured to cast mass incarceration, as the title indicates, as a plague, and the approach is from the approach of epidemiology. And early on in the book, Ernie talks about when he was in the South Bronx running a drug program and facing the very beginning of the evidence of the AIDS epidemic. Now, at that point, all people knew was that anybody who had AIDS would die. That's all anybody knew. And Ernie was working with a population that it looked as if they might all be affected by AIDS. So on a daily basis, this man risked his life. At least he didn't know that he wasn't. And so when I say that he has courage, I'm not kidding. I think to face that sort of challenge is something extraordinary in our society, which is why I say he's an extraordinary person. Now, Ethan is a very articulate and brilliant man who left academia to tackle this issue of drugs and drug policy in the United States. He's been a consistent warrior in that battle. It's not a popular cause, but he is beginning to see that people are accepting some of the thoughts that he has advanced and the analysis which he's used. He stays with it and has stayed with it ever since he's gotten involved. And now I think, principally because of Ethan, one can see some cracks in the wall of prejudice. By the way, as an ethical matter, the Committee on Ethics tells me, as I had to tell Ernie, I cannot write a blurb for his book. It's probably just as well, it would might well ruin it, but I can't do that. But what I can do is to stand up for and do honor to a friend and an excellent author and to his vision and to his courage. This book is a mind changer. This is a paradigm changer. Now, the degree to which what is said in this book is going to be accepted by America, I suppose I can only hope. And I guess maybe, in a sense, I can predict. This is sort of the Gettysburg Address for our age. You will remember, the world will little note, nor long remember what we say here, but it can never forget what they did here. Well, now just change it a little bit and put me in the ones that think you're going to forget. But this book may last, and I hope will be a changing influence on our society. I've, as you've heard, I've been a judge now for 33 years, and occasionally one has moments of reflection. I see one of my partners here, and she knows that I don't reflect too often, but I do on occasion. And one of the things that I was been thinking about was, what do I think about my job? What do I think about the justice system? And I thought about it, and I came to the conclusion that by and large, the justice system works pretty well. And as you've heard, I've traveled around a bit and seen other systems and how they work. And I really think that what we have as a system is about as good as there is anywhere in the world. But it has, in my one thing about it that has been, to me, extremely difficult and very unsatisfying, and that is the issue of punishment and how the society deals with those who break the rules and deals with those who society thinks need to be dealt with. And that's a very discouraging, for me, it has been a very discouraging process. And what you will find in this book are some pretty hard facts. There is mention of $1 trillion. You'll find that as the cost of our system. You will find the numbers of those presently incarcerated or in the system at 2.5 million. So what we have is a system that, and the case is made from a marvelous perspective, that is the perspective of a scientist who is trying to deal with cause and effect in a disease framework, and that's Ernie's point. I have no assurance, but I do believe that a book of this kind it gives us the possibility of shifting from a retributive, punitive system to a system that is restorative. And those are Ernie's ideas. The idea of treating mass incarceration as a disease and trying to get America to recognize that it should be an issue of health, public health, everybody's health. I hope the book is a roaring success. The ideas are absolutely appropriate, I believe. Maybe a little Goethe is appropriate. Daring ideas are like chessmen moved forward. They may be beaten, but they start a winning game. This may be the start of a winning game.
Thank you. Well, it is. It's great to be up here with Bob and Ernie, because these are two guys who I go back. We go back to the late 1980s together in terms of our advocacy for drug law reform, and with the Drug Policy Foundation, and with Bob stepping out. I remember getting a call from Bob in the summer of 1989. When he'd been on the court for maybe a decade or so, saying he wanted to give a speech about legalizing drugs, and could I help him with the draft of that? And so we talked. He seemed awfully radical, to my sense. I thought I was radical. He was really radical. But sure enough, he came out with that speech and landed up on the front page of the New York Times in December of 1989. It was one of the things that helped spark a lively and important debate in the midst of the peak of the drug war. And Ernie, I mean, Ernie has been spinning this stuff out. You know, the thing about Ernie is his capacity to spin out innovative ideas for research and advocacy is unparalleled. I mean, his mind and the way it can spin these things in every single direction, and the ways in which he has spun out ideas that others have run with, that he's managed to talk about. But, you know, the one thing he had never done was write a book. You know, and, you know, here... And I think, you know, we should probably give a hand of applause to Diane Wachtel, the publisher, as well, because that skill of extracting from a brilliant scholar like Ernie the ability to put this all together here is really quite something. So I think what I just wanted to talk about a bit was a few comments about the book and Ernie's take in all this, and then just some thoughts about how this book fits into what's going on now. You know, part of what's so valuable about this thing is that apart from the perspective he brings to bring, the public health paradigm that he brings to bear on this thing, he's detailing all of the various, you know, primary, secondary, and tertiary consequences of the war on drugs and of a mass incarceration strategy. I mean, one after another, ones that all of us have heard about, and other ones which are little tidbits brought together from one study or another that I didn't know about, I'm sure many of you didn't know about, and he pulls all that stuff together here in a very real way. Now, part of what's a bit unnerving, of course, is that since the three of us met back around 1988 or 89, in fact, the number of people locked up on drug charges has roughly doubled. The number of people who've spun through the system has increased by the millions. The number of people who died of HIV has increased by the tens or hundreds of thousands in the United States and millions around the world. There's the range of things, right, that have happened, have continued to happen. So part of what he's detailing is, in a way, there's a part about the, you know, we look back on how we got started in this in the late 80s, And the advocacy efforts that we've all built and that George Soros and Open Society have been so supportive of and others, and yet we realize that we're still up against this vast juggernaut, you know, this vast juggernaut where we can trip it up and elbow it off the tracks a bit and try to change public consciousness around pieces of the thing and move here and there, but it really is powerful. A lot of these charts and these numbers show the progress, not just of things leading up to 1989, but in fact, things that have happened in those last two decades since that time. You know, I mean, there was this period. It's this funny way when you can look back on the 1970s as almost the kind of benevolent period in our past, I guess, in many areas, you know, including the drug one. And where, you know, you see how even as this drug policy reform movement and the movement against mass incarceration grows, how we keep, you know, the power of this thing, the inertial forces behind it. I know sometimes I find myself in debates with advocates of well, nobody wants to call himself a drug war advocate anymore, really.
You know, even the drug czars don't like that term. But people who believe in this policy of high-level incarceration and demonization and moralization around drugs, and what they will tend to say is, you know, look, we've actually made progress with the war on drugs. I mean, you look back in 1980 and Jimmy Carter's days, and I mean, 40 million Americans were using illegal drugs, had said, you know, that they're using illegal drugs back then, and now it's down to 20 or 25 million. Look, I mean, we're actually succeeding. All of this policy has been so successful. And unfortunately, what's not being said typically by most elected officials, but which I and a few others have the privilege of being able to say, is, wait a second. Yes, in 1980, 40 million Americans admitted to violating the drug law, and now it's down to 20 or 25 million. But so what? So what? Because I'll tell you something else. First of all, back in 1980, most of those people violating the drug laws were either like high school kids or college kids smoking marijuana or yuppies snorting cocaine. I mean, it wasn't as if we had a major drug abuse problem back then. Right? And I'll say, you know, 1980? I mean, 1980 may have highlighted drug use, but 1980, nobody ever heard of crack cocaine. But by 1990, it became a national epidemic. In 1980, nobody had heard of drug-related HIV or AIDS, but by 1990, hundreds of thousands were infected, and now we have hundreds of thousands who have died as a result of that. In 1980, there were 50,000 people locked up for a drug law violation in American state prisons, federal prisons, local jails. Now it's 500,000 people, a tenfold increase. 1980, we were spending maybe $2 or $3 billion between federal and state governments on the war on drugs. Now it's $40 billion, $50 billion, $60 billion, right? So I say, you know, you want to talk about progress. In 1980 seems to me actually like the best of all years, notwithstanding the fact that it was the point of the highest levels of illegal drug use in American history. And the period of 1990 and 2010 seemed to me like the worst of all years. Part of what, of course, it comes down to is the question about what's the measure of success or failure. And part of what Ernie's doing in this book is saying that there is a paradigm, there is a measure that we should all be agreeing on, which it's not about how many people used a drug or admitted to a government pollster that they used an illegal drug last year. That the real bottom line is, to what extent is the drug war responsible for increasing or decreasing the number of people dying of drug overdoses and HIV, AIDS, and hepatitis C, and filling prisons with nonviolent offenders and taking taxpayer dollars from one area and putting them into the criminal justice, you know, enterprise on the other hand? That those are fundamentally the key criteria that one has to focus on, and that possibly can become the basis of a middle ground of an emerging consensus that unites left, right, and center around drug policy reform, right? So on the one hand, it's a bit depressing in a way to read this book and read about this plague which has accelerated, or not accelerated, been over the last 20-odd years. And also, I pull back and I start asking myself certain questions, like, Ernie, you have this fascinating chart in here about mental institutions and the number of people institutionalized in mental institutions back in the middle of the last century, and how the rates of institutionalization were something like 500 per 100,000, I mean, something approaching what the American incarceration rate is. And then you can see, beginning in the 70s, with a massive movement towards deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill, you see those numbers dropping by about 90%. And meanwhile, during the same period of time, the number of people with mental illness locked up in prisons and jails increasing by about 900%, right, to roughly 500,000 people, almost as if we had a population shift from putting people with mental illness into, you know, from mental institutions into prisons. But then I'd be curious, because then you start off with your whole epidemiological analysis saying, well, but what, let's look at the puzzle here. Which people are they? Was, in fact, it a trade? Or, in fact, were the people who were institutionalized back in the middle of the century disproportionately poor people and people of color, et cetera? Or are we talking about different populations? I wonder also, you know, I remember actually, part of being here brings back memories, because from 1994 to 2000, before we had the Drug Policy Alliance, one of the two organizations that became the Drug Policy Alliance was the Lindesmith Center. And we held roughly 100 seminars in this room right here. I think many of you came to those back then with all sorts of speakers, including, I think, Bob and Ernie in those years. But one of the other projects that was going on down the hall was the Gun Control Project. Right? Soros has got involved in this sort of stuff. And part of the approach that they were trying to bring to it was a public health approach to gun control and gun violence. And I'm actually not sure how that worked out. I don't know if you know,
But I'm curious to see, here was the idea that let's bring a new approach, a public health approach to the problems of gun violence, and maybe shifting this paradigm will make a difference. I'd love to know if maybe somebody in the audience knows how that worked out and whether or not, in fact, there are insights here. Now, last few points I want to say is, what Ernie doesn't fully emphasize here, and that's been done to some extent by others, and it pops up here, is that when we're talking about the plague of prisons, we're mostly talking about an American epidemic. I mean, the Russians are kind of got a bit of it, and there's a couple of other,
It's in America, right.
But looking at this stuff comparatively, I mean, there's a few other countries, you know, which also, you know, Belarus, I think Bermuda. I mean, you know, weird places, right? But, you know, which have very high rates. But there's this element of American exceptionalism. Right, that here, if you look and compare us to Europe, what you see is our rates of illegal drug use aren't really that different. It's a bit higher than much of Europe, but certain countries have higher rates of different types of use. And, you know, this whole notion that we Americans consume more illegal drugs than anybody, the whole world put together, that's not right. The evidence is not there. You know, we don't have the highest heroin addiction rate. We don't have the highest marijuana use rates. You know, we're up there, but we're not. We don't have the highest rates of nonviolent crime. We have high rates of violent crime as sort of, you know, northern industrialized countries go. But we rely on incarceration at 4, 6, 7, 8 times the rate of other countries with roughly similar rates or slightly lower rates of nonviolent, you know, and that question about how other countries manage to do or deal with a problem of similar issues without relying on prison. Is it that they are using this a sort of public health mentality? Is that part of what they bring? I think actually probably the answer partially is yes, that they're thinking more holistically about how to deal with this broader problem, and that, you know, that part of the answer is that they have a different way of thinking than the American way of thinking. Now, Ernie lands up in this book talking about maybe things are turning. He makes the point that the number of people locked up in state prisons after increasing steadily for 30 years finally appears to be turning downward a little bit. Now, it's still going up in federal prisons, and it still may go up in local jails. And you take what's going on in California right now with the realignment plan where they're going to shove tens of thousands of people from state prisons to local jails. Overall, a good thing, we think, but it's going to shift stats in ways that, you know, we have to keep our eye on the broader picture. But he does point out the fact that there is something changing. You know, it's maybe not quite as new as Bob was suggesting. I mean, there is momentum. When you see what's happening around sentencing reform, when you see states like New York and New Jersey, which have decreased their state prison populations, as Ernie points out, by 15 or 20%, and states like Kansas or Michigan also bringing them down, when you see the rush of support for sentencing reform driven in good part by budgetary pressures, but not only, when you see the Right on Crime initiative, people on right coming to the table with people on the left and beginning to say enough is enough, when you see not just Democratic but Republican governors saying we can't afford to keep locking people up this way, more support for alternatives to incarceration, when you see people in parole and probation trying to find ways to stop violating people for everything, every little dirty urine, when you see dramatically the movement on marijuana reform and the Gallup polls showing dramatic leaps in support for not just decriminalizing but legalizing marijuana over the last 5 or 6 years, to the point where now 46% of Americans favor legalizing marijuana use, only 50% against, that's a switch from 36 to 46 in support in just 5 years, and from 60 against to 50 against in just 5 years. So there's really movement happening. When you see the things that Obama ran on and included in his campaign and actually made good on in his first year, unfortunately pulling back from almost all of it right now, but you saw that there was some momentum for reform. Things are moving in more or less in a right direction. Now, it doesn't mean that there's not a schizophrenia going on where the same legislators who one day can vote to reduce incarceration or roll back a crack powder sentence, and the next day they vote to criminalize some new drug they've never heard of, whether it's salvia or K2 spice or bath salts or whatever the local, you know, flavor of the month is, right? So there's that old drug war mentality that continues to just sort of pop out sort of out of control. But the fact is we're in a period of transition. And so the last thing I wonder when I read this book is, so as somebody who's committed to advocacy, and as many of us are here, I'm asking myself, if you make up a list and imagine who are the people you most want to read this book, who might conceivably read the book, right? There's who are the people who sort of get it, but where these people would get it that much more? Who are the people for whom this understanding, that thinking about, that when we're talking about public health there, Ernie's not primarily talking about the way we normally talk about this. Let's shift from a criminal justice problem to a public health problem. Let's shift from treating drug addiction as criminal to health. That's in it. But he's taking, stepping back one extra step to saying, bring the public health paradigm to the whole picture. Think in terms of primary, secondary, and tertiary prevention. Will there be people in the criminal justice establishment who can be influenced by this? Is this the book, and I think it might be, for the public health establishment, the people who have been sort of struggling with this thing about how to take this another level, who might actually say that this is it? I think that ultimately, the greatest contribution that this book can and probably will make will be in bringing in new allies from the public health field and from some surprising new areas who get it in a way they never did before, because Ernie wrote this book. So, Ernie, thank you very, very much for doing this.
Well, I couldn't be more comfortable with all this praise and sitting between a spiritual father and a spiritual brother and all of this. We go back a long way, and it's been very nice to have such good friends, and because God knows I didn't think of this stuff myself. The paradigm shift is a very important thing for me, and the model for that is not just because it's cute to call it public health rather than criminal justice, but because I was there hiding under my desk when I was 10 years old for nuclear weapons, and I learned about fears and dangers and the insanity of wrong-headed approaches to serious issues. There's a series about prohibition on now, which I think is very timely, because I think there's a huge generation that knows nothing of what that term means or what the experience is, that in fact we tried to outlaw drugs before. We changed the Constitution to do it, and it was a disaster. And I loved the ad in one of the newspapers for the show, which was how could a country that was so right get it so wrong? You know, we weren't so right in every way, but we certainly got it wrong. And everyone who grew up in that generation learned the lesson of that. But they forgot it in time to have drug prohibition. Obviously, the mechanism was the apparatus of alcohol prohibition fought, like every mechanism, to keep its job and expand its domain and increase its power, and that gave us the DEA. But that's routine in organisms like bureaucracies and governments. But something else happened here in the United States around attitudes about how people should behave, which every society has. That's what the laws are about. But something happened. It may have been the religious dimension of it, and the kind of divisions that brought about. You know, the early prohibition was as much about the Irish as it was about alcohol in the history of alcohol prohibition. And we all know what the early years of the drug zealotry were about. They go on today, and they just connected to any way you could think of someone being inferior. So right back to Jim Crow, in the case of race, a wonderful book by Michelle Alexander, one of the authors of New Press, called The New Jim Crow, in which she gives light to a very important fact that there are as many African Americans in the prison system now as at the height of slavery in 1860. It's a bigger country, but it gives you a sense of scale. Anyway, the example about the paradigm shift came to me from the experience with nuclear war, nuclear weapons. I was very active in that. I dropped out of engineering because I thought it was bad karma to make atom bombs. And I paid attention to this and began to realize that there was a group that was taking action to change people's minds, and it turned out to be the health profession, physicians for social responsibility, but also the mothers movement for end of nuclear testing in the 1950s. And my dear friend Jack Geiger, who can't be here tonight, is quite ill, and other doctors up in Boston and here in New York, collected baby teeth, which had strontium-90 in it, from the milk that the cows drank, which had nuclear fallout on it, from the tests in the Pacific and in Nevada. And they put those teeth, talk about community organizing, put the teeth on a table, and they took a Geiger counter, you know, with an amplifier, and they put it next to it, and what's that? Oh, that's the radiation in your baby's teeth. Why is that? Well, because these morons are lighting off bombs in the atmosphere, that, you know, 200 miles west of here, and we undermined the credibility of the people who argue we have to have testing, we have to have more nuclear testing to fight the Russians, because we're so afraid of the Russians. And what they did is they shifted the belief from the fear of being attacked with nuclear weapons to the fear of the weapons themselves, which is very appropriate because they don't discriminate. And the problem went from being the dangerous Russians and our enemies to being this proliferation of nuclear weapons. The same model, the massiveness of them made all the difference in the world. That was a paradigm shift of great consequence. And, you know, the last several presidents of the United States have been committed, along with many other world leaders, to at least minimizing, talk about harm reduction, minimizing the number of nuclear weapons. We can always build new ones, but so that's a model of a paradigm shift. And it seemed to me the analogous thing in criminal justice was what Judge Sweet said before, the punishment issue. That it's always been about crime and punishment. Because fear is attached to crime. We've all been victims of crime. Many of us have committed crimes, and we've all been punished. It's not like the experience of those things is alien to us as individuals. But the individual experience of crime and punishment is as different from the system of punishment that we've created as an individual case of disease, influenza, let's say, is from a collective nature of it is very different than what you do about it as a health professional is different. Case of AIDS, you use antiretrovirals, so you treat it. And in the case of preventing the spread of AIDS, you're dealing with sex and drugs and blood. And that's and you talk about transmission. It's the social network, if you will. And that everything that happens in public health, it rides on the social network that exists. It finds the fault lines in it to move and takes advantage of distinctions that are in the system that weaken people and make them, what's vulnerability and risk mean for HIV in America? Well, it's race and age. You look at all the studies, the rates are so much higher. And is there something biological about race and age that makes you susceptible to HIV infection and sex or blood transfer? No, it's the social arrangements in which your sex and age exist. And that lesson of social networks, they're important, has carried over to the prisons at this point, because they are this hugely powerful politically, economically, and numerically social network system that's very, very damaging to everyone that's in it. It's very much like the nuclear mining industry was a dangerous industry, and it took decades to get compensation for people who were damaged in doing that. And the same thing has happened with 35 years of mass incarceration in America. Now, probably 10 million people have passed through this system in its time. And each has been wounded by it in their own way. Some people are, you know, have been in worse kinds of situations and done very well. But the more adverse, toxic kind of exposure you give to people in any place in public health, the more bad outcomes you get. And that's what the prison system's about. And the best evidence of that is the fact that it sucks people back into it. It keeps them in it. You know, for life, really. A Russian waiter in a Brighton Beach restaurant showed me his passport with a stamp. He heard us talking about prison. He shows me this passport with a stamp in it. Go to prison in Russia, bang, it's in your passport for life. And that's true now here, too, via the computers. There are 65 million adult criminal records extant in the United States that have fingerprints with them. And somebody got arrested. God knows for what. What happens, charge, who knows? But the fingerprints and the charge and exist in a computer. At this point, 63 million different Americans, close to 30%. So the technologies are there for surveillance and control. Proposal today in the article in the paper about states adding drug tests as a hurdle for welfare. So you see them moving backward in many ways. Ethan talked about some progress. I tend to notice these nasty examples of the failure of the system because the drug issue has never gone away as a political tool. A wonderful book by Jonathan Simon called Governing Through Crime. It's really governing through fear. And people have used fear of crime forever to stimulate all kinds of reactions against groups of people, to move money around from one group to another. That game will it's human society, it will never change. But when you amp it up to the level that we have now, it's as different as a case of flu is from an influenza epidemic. That's the point of this. So you need other kinds of tools. than the individual model of crime and punishment, which I think the judicial system does do okay, pretty much, you know, with its blind spots and its prejudices. But one of the things when you amp a system up so high, the quality of the personnel who work in it are not primarily determined by who wants to work on this difficult problem of justice. Look at the public defenders. I work with wonderful public defenders around the country. And they know what the odds are, 95% plea bargain guilty rate, and that they're willing to work day in and day out at trying to minimize the harms done to people caught up in the system, because these guys got on the back of a bus in the Bronx, and if they go to Rikers, ICE will get them, the immigration people, and they'll never be seen in the neighborhood again. They're back to Salvador, Guatemala, wherever they send them. So the day-to-day workings of this system at that scale are so destructive of so many individuals, families, communities. Erica Doris here, who's, you know, wonderful documentation of the money associated with locking up, you know, 50 people from one apartment house in Bushwick, you know, $5 million a year spent on one block locking people up. That's the equivalent of what? 50, 60 personnel that could actually be useful to that community? God knows they need it. So it's not that the money isn't there to do that. We know where it's gone. People in California know where it's gone now. They had the best public school system in the country. Now they have the biggest prison system and one of the worst public school systems in the country. So that's what's so wonderful about the people in Wall Street. And I understand marching down Fifth Avenue, Park Avenue earlier today. People are mad as hell and they don't want to take it anymore. They're mad for different reasons. We know about the Tea Party, who went out front first in this. But there's a lot of other people besides the Tea Party. I've been doing radio shows around the country. There's a lot of people thinking about these things. There's a lot of sympathy for solving the problem of prisons. That's the different thing. That's the paradigm shift. The problem is prisons. It's not crime. Yeah, we can deal with crime. So thank you all very much for organizing this and being here. It's really an honor and a pleasure. And I hope that we can all do something for justice, because that's the point of this exercise. Once that, you know, someone said I'd gone from drugs to AIDS to justice, and it is the most challenging thing of all. But for an old man like me, it's appropriate at this point. I've been lucky in life, I think that if we really concentrate on having a just society and hold that up as our standard, we can't go wrong in any kind of situation. That's the best we can do. But also, I think one of the good things about the United States is there are people here who really do believe in justice, large numbers, hundreds of millions of them, actually. And I think we can speak to their better angels, and just making the case of what kind of damage gets done. I speak to audiences all the time about this, and you know, how many people here have had someone in prison, you know, and what happened to them afterward. Everyone has this experience now, actually. So there's a real base we can work on. And thank you all for coming.
So that gentleman is turning the mic on so that people can ask questions. And as people are kind of gathering their thoughts and thinking about the questions they might ask, I'd like to ask Ernie a question. So the paradigm shift that you talk about, thinking of not of crime as the problem, but of mass incarceration as the problem, I wonder if you have thoughts on how that's going to be achieved. You know, my background before I came to DPA is in political campaigns, so I'm always thinking about, well, what do the voters think? What do the average people think? And I remember that with the AIDS epidemic, it took a long time for that epidemic to be recognized and taken seriously, because it affected stigmatized groups, and it wasn't until people got worried that HIV would spread to the general population that people started paying attention to it. So with respect to mass incarceration, my sense is that it's not registering beyond the people who are already, who know what's going on. And so my question to you is, how do you make the general public aware of an epidemic that's in its midst?
Talk about it. You show pictures, you do PowerPoints, you go into your kids' classrooms, you do whatever it takes to say there's this huge crime against humanity taking place in your neighborhood, and call it what it is. Explain what's wrong with it. Bring people who, you know, who have been in prison to come in and talk about how uplifting that experience is, and show the movies as what they are, rather than, you know, the triumph of might over evil is the way television portrays it. Because that's not what's going on. Everyone knows that. Everyone who's implicated in it knows it. Both the enforcers and the and that those truths got to be told. I was teaching in prison last year for the Bard program up in the Catskills, and I was impressed at the pool of talent, intelligence, and comprehension, and the ability to actually produce significant work. But it's hard to get it out of the prison, actually. And, you know, the internet is not allowed. One has tried very hard to change that. You can have things that are not unlimited internet, like the John Jay Library across the street is a close. Most of what you need from the internet to do research, why isn't that in every prison? Oh, yes, I'm sorry, I'm getting it. The light has to go on. Okay. Anyway, I think that the opportunities to change people's thinking, and not, you say the voter, when you raised before, I don't think it rises to that level. You're operating at a more fundamental emotional level, at least I am. And that's the kind of change. It's just like the mother's understanding that those nuclear tests in Nevada were poisoning their children. When that connection gets made on a massive basis, you have a movement that, and the votes follow. There was a wonderful Swedish comic who used to go around during the anti-nuclear days, anti-war days, and do a routine like on a talk show, and he'd say, you know, you look at these peace demonstrations. There were always three kinds of people in them: there's women, and there's children, and there's women. And I think he, you know, he got some point about who, you know, who had that nurturing link to their children that took seriously the threats. That's what those strontium teeth represented to any normal person. So when you move people at that level, I think the votes follow. And I also have no idea how to move them at the voting level, because the voting system is so. I saw this movie Ides of March the other day, which will chill you out on the old political system. Hi, Matt.
Hi, Ernie. Thanks for writing the book. I haven't read it yet. I will, and I'll buy it on the way out of the door and give it to my friends. We're actually doing a session at the American Public Health Association.
Could you introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm Maddie DeLone. I'm the executive director of the Innocence Project by day, and I'm a 24-year member of the American Public Health Association's Jail and Prison Health Committee. So we are actually having, in 1991, January 1st, APHA passed a public health, mass incarceration is a public health problem. Every public health professional should end mass incarceration. It's destroying our communities. And we're having a session at APHA in D.C. next month. 20 years later, 1.3 million people more in prison. What's APHA going to do? I actually, when I sent that out for a session, just reminding people to come to the session, somebody who's involved in the World Health Federation of Public Health Associations, you know the group I don't, said, oh, that's, you know, that's very interesting because we're trying to figure out what the World Health Federation should say about mass incarceration. So I'm assuming that the end of your book tells us what our marching orders are in terms of what the public health community is supposed to do, but could you just give us a little bit of a preview of when we talk to all these people, and now I can prepare the talk, it'll be very good, thank you, what we should tell people to do from the public health perspective, because we agree, it's a public health crisis, has been for a long time and getting worse.
Simply, it's chapter 10 of the book is about there's three levels, Ethan mentioned, three levels of prevention in public health: primary, secondary, tertiary. Primary means prevent the cases from happening. Okay, how do you prevent cases of imprisonment from happening? You don't put people in prison for some of the. Now, is there ever going to be a society in the world which doesn't want to lock somebody or need to lock someone up because they're out of control and dangerous? Of course not. But the levels that we have now, which we know are so damaging, we can make a decision to put a cap on it, like we put a cap on the size of the military or the number of college students that we have in the country or the number of hospital beds. There's no cap on it now, and that's one of the reasons why it's been like catnip for politicians. You know, there was no consequence of deciding these decisions that carried huge financial implications, California being the case where it's had such a clear impact. So primary prevention, fewer people in prison. Practically, low-level nonviolent drug offenders. There are 600,000 people who go to prison each year in the country. About 200,000 of those are low-level drug offenders. So you can cut almost a third out of the intake of this population. The other side is secondary prevention. Secondary prevention means where you can't prevent a case of the infection, using an infection as a model, you can't prevent all of them, so you got to treat some of them. That's what secondary prevention is, treatment. And sometimes that means you also prevent transmission. In the case of TB or HIV, we know effective treatment of HIV lowers the probability of transmission of HIV. So secondary prevention in this case means changing prison conditions for those who are sentenced already. You can't make those go away. That's millions of people who are on parole as well. So changing conditions so they're not so destructive and punitive to people. Take an opportunity of people being in prison to help them reconstruct their lives, education being the most obvious thing to do. And there ought to be educational programs in every community. You know, the funds for education in prison were cut off in the Clinton years, the Pell Grants. And some people stepped up to the plate, most notably the people at Bard with the help of Soros especially. And it's made a huge difference. They've graduated 150 people from New York State prisons. I've had the privilege of working with many of them. There are several who are out now who are working with us at John Jay, a couple of them doing their doctorates. And these guys know what they're talking about. And they're getting the rigorous background to apply it to a very, very important dimension. Tertiary prevention, the last part of public health, is you haven't prevented the case from happening. You haven't been successfully cured the case, because in treatment you're going to have cure, or you can have incurable conditions that are chronic. And then you try to minimize harm. It's a harm reduction model, disability being the most important one. So you reduce the disabilities associated with the condition that has been a guy has spent 25 years in prison. Guys go to supermaxes where they're in solitary for 8 years. That's damage. That's like the fact that it mimics the effects of traumatic brain injury. So those people need treatment, and they need maintenance. They need an environment that can help them survive the rest of their years, which will be shortened. But you also need structural. I meant for what you do for the individuals involved. Don't put that guy in jail. Don't make jail a situation where his mental status and his drug problem get worse. Take the opportunity to help them with those things. But even you got someone who's an old veteran of that system, there are many things you do that are humane. But if you look at it socially rather than just clinically, you can say there needs to be something to address the punishment, the impulse to punishment, because that's what's driving the front door. The input is the acceptance of harsh punishments and harsh sentences, mandatory sentences being the poster child, the acceptance of that model as being consistent with justice, which is supposed to take individual differences into account. That's the good thing about the justice system. It's not a public health system. It's like the good thing about medicine is it's each patient is different. It's what we always want from our doctor, it's what we want from our lawyer, it's what we want from our judge. And you take that as a system, you mechanize punishment, as they did with mandatory drug sentencing in this country, and suddenly the thing turns into a monster. At another level, socially, we got to make peace around this. I see it as a civil war. If you look at the numbers that are involved, the damages that have been done, the potential years of life lost, it's right up there with a great civil war. I mentioned the slavery comparison before. And of all the models that I've seen for dealing with that on a population basis, of restorative justice is the term that's used for them, is the truth and reconciliation process that's gone on in South Africa and is now going on in Rwanda and other places in the world. The idea that people who have terrible conflicts, the most monstrous thing that you could imagine happening, genocide, still may have to live together in that country for the future. And there are millions of them, and all of them weren't murdered, and all of them weren't murderers, and there they are. And very interesting meeting here in this room a few weeks ago about Rwanda and the huge conflict going on between a very authoritarian, sometimes murderous president who's insisting that his countrymen get to be able to live together again. And what's happening just doing that process, not terribly large scale yet, is that the country is stable. Homicide is one of the lowest in Central Africa. There's a sign of hope about resolving a generational conflict, which now is there with the ex-prisoners. The prisoners that come out are so damaged and stigmatized by what's happened. Their families are so shocked by it, they can't reintegrate there. And now with the latest thing about having drug tests for everybody who wants to get any kind of benefit on the spot, and the technology that gets better and better, you're going to create a leper colony, basically, of people that are easy to identify. They're in the computers. They have DNA chips. You know, God knows. No one's going to be able, you know, a lot of it was the inefficiency in the past. You could dodge around the edges of the system if you were clever enough. But it's going to get very, very hard to do. If you want to get a paycheck, you're going to be on some record system, and you're going to be picked. So what's going to happen to those millions of people who have been made unemployable by doing this, uneducable? They can't get into a school, can't get a loan. So there's got to be a sense of responsibility for the consequences of these decisions. That's the bottom line.
I want to ask Judge Sweet, just in terms of your work with individual cases, individuals dealing with criminal justice cases, how have you seen things change over the 30 years that we've been talking about, when the number of cases skyrocketed? And what would be different about your work in the criminal justice system were it to be seen more in the way that Dr. Drucker talks about in the book, more as an epidemiological type of issue?
Things have changed. When I first was sworn in, there was no death penalty in the federal system except for treason. And I sort of thought to myself that that's not going to happen every day, so maybe I don't have to worry about that too much. Of course, that's changed. Also, when I started, there were no guidelines. Every judge was free to do whatever he or she thought was appropriate within the statute, the limitation that the statute had for the penalty. So we had flexibility. And Marvin Frankel, who was then a judge, decided that he would experiment, and so he gave us all in the Southern District a hypothetical case and then asked us for for our decisions. And predictably, those decisions covered quite a wide range. What nobody really pointed out was that the bell curve was also rather large, so that there was a consensus. And that, I think, was one of the beginnings of the guideline system, which turned judges from people who tried to look at a situation, a particular crime, a particular individual, and do the just thing, into accountants with tables and grids and a diminution of discretion. And then, of course, mandatory minimums developed. And so the curve of punitive action went up and limiting the judge's capacity to do what a particular judge thought was the right thing. So on the other hand, now the Supreme Court has stricken, I declared the guidelines unconstitutional, parenthetically. It wasn't a successful attempt, but it was the right thing. And oddly enough, now the Supreme Court has backed around, and we can now get out of the guidelines. All we have to do is to refer to the statute that Congress had passed some time ago about the goals of punishment, which has got everything but the kitchen sink in it and is completely contradictory. So there's progress. And I think we're getting back to a point where judges have now capacity to be more individual in their decisions. Now, so I think there is some degree of hope and of progress, and as Ethan has noted, there is a beginning consensus on maybe this mandatory minimum idea isn't so good. It seems to me, as we examine this mass incarceration, I think maybe one of the levers which may pry some minds open are the economic consequences. And I think the California problem, which has been mentioned, it just makes it absolutely clear. I think if we could get, and I have hoped there was pending a bill put in by Senator Webb for a study of the criminal justice system. And if we could ever get anybody to make an honest economic analysis of the entirety of that problem, I think it would wake up America. So perhaps there is hope.
Robert Dannon. Ernie, you saved the evening because I was becoming a bit uncomfortable with the abstractions by the other speakers, because this really is largely about minorities. And the other thing that we haven't talked about is agency. Who are responsible for these laws? And if you want to basically be real about it, which way we're moving, all you have to do is look at the new laws on voter disenfranchisement. So my question is, to the people who are involved in the so-called reform movement, why not just call it genocide? And what are the consequences when you do call it genocide?
I think the use of the term genocide is a counterproductive term. I think there's many, many other powerful terms to be used that are probably as successful with the audience for whom the genocide terminology would work, but which don't raise all the hackles and problems that the use of the genocide terminology does raise.
That's not a satisfactory answer. That's just basically an answer that supports your career.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Oh, Chris Norwood. I'm not going to express this properly scientifically, but with all that we're learning through brain imaging about how young brains worked and are formed, from a public health standpoint and a human standpoint, couldn't we start to say that, say, through 500,000 stops and frisks a year in our city, which are focused on young minority men to the extent that some are stopped 20 times a year, that we're almost training them to not quite become criminals, but we're training their brain pathways to be in constant interaction with the police? Am I expressing this in a way that, and I know you're doing some work on cortisol and so forth.
The thing is that Chris's observation about the kids, what about the kids, is finally becoming the subject of serious research. I'm part of a big study at Columbia of looking at the children of incarcerated parents. And no one's ever done that before in a rigorous way, looking at psychological, physiological effects of incarceration. The effects on the brain of that kind of trauma, persistent trauma, that's the difference between one shock, which you resilient person can get over, but the constant bang, bang, bang is actually observable in cortisol measurements. The kid's cortisol, which is your stress response system, becomes refractory. It doesn't respond as well. You can think of this as being the neurological mechanism of callousness, which you have to breed into yourself if you live in an environment where you're getting hit all the time. And what you describe, Chris, is very much like being hit. There's a very poignant chapter of this, of especially single African-American moms with teenage boys who tutor them in how to avoid getting in trouble with the cops, how not to confront them, how to look down, shuffle around, a whole, you know, demeaning thing, because the mother is rightfully concerned. She knows the stats. Rightfully concerned about what can happen to her son if he talks back to the cops, if he's black. And the data are totally clear about that. The prejudice and racism in this country are nothing new. They get institutionalized in all kinds of ways all the time. It comes back again and again if you think you've defeated having a black president. That's supposed to be the new millennium. Well, it ain't. I think that the effects on the physiology of people, of the stress of incarceration in communities, is very great. Chris Wildman, who's a young sociology professor at Yale, did an incredible study basically showing that the infant mortality rate, the number of children who die before the age of one, is 25% higher in the children of parents who have gone to prison than it is in similar people who haven't gone to prison. And that accounts for a large differential, but the black-white differential in infant mortality that exists now. So there are all these data around that you can use to marshal to talk to these things, but who's the audience for it? You know, well, we've got to create an audience that is looking to substantiate their gut understanding that what's going on is wrong and bad. Give them the ammunition, give them the tools. So I'm very focused in, like, as a website for the book, and I'm focused in building that into something that high school teachers, that high school students can use to teach about mass incarceration.
I was just going to add to that, Chris. You know, this thing about the stop and frisk in New York and the $600,000 a year, and I think many of you probably saw in the newspapers recently about what happened with the marijuana arrests, and as a result of a collective effort by Drug Policy Alliance and a range of other organizations in New York, there actually was a victory. At least it appears to be a victory right now. Again, where Bloomberg and Kelly, the police commissioner, were obliged to back down on the issue of these high levels of marijuana arrests. I mean, it's not very often that Ray Kelly backs down on anything. It remains to be seen, but basically what they're requiring now is that they didn't say anything about reducing the stop and frisk, but they did say that when they frisk somebody and marijuana shows up, they're no longer going to be arresting them, fingerprinting them, taking down the station, all this sort of thing. But the report that Harry Levine and Deborah Small did on this a few years ago, and in Harry Levine's subsequent reports and the work that Lauren Siegel here is doing with Harry, he makes some very powerful points. One's very similar, Chris, to what you were saying, which is that there's an element of almost training young people, especially young men of color, to become part of the criminal justice system. It's almost an indoctrination into, here's the role you're supposed to play, get used to it, right? The other thing that's significant is that with respect to the issue of racial disproportionality in the war on drugs, there was something about this issue which was so clear and blatant, even more so, because one could look at, you know, the crack arrests and all that stuff, and that finally seized the attention of Congress over years. But still, you have this popular perception, more black people are using crack or dealing crack. But when you have a very easily stated fact to state, which is that if you randomly stop 100 young white men, 100 young brown men, 100 young black men, that the percentage of them who have marijuana in their pocket is going to be roughly equal, or maybe a little less among the black kids, but they're getting busted, arrested at 7 times the rate, even the people who don't ever want to think about the race dimension of this issue go, I get it. So it was very powerful in that specific case.
Ernie, hi. First thing I want to say, I come from a 99.9% white state, Vermont, and we rank highest in the nation among teens in marijuana smoking and addiction. So it's also a socioeconomic issue, not just a race issue. And what I was hoping Ernie could maybe address, when you look at an epidemiological prevention model, you've got to start with juvenile justice and really start from the beginning. And I haven't read your book yet, but I'm your largest promoter in Vermont right now. I've given away 4. So I don't know if the book addresses this, looking at the juvenile justice system, because at least where I come from, 80% of the kids who get involved in the juvenile justice system matriculate into the adult system. Have you looked at that research-wise, and can you comment on it?
Well,
Well, it's certainly true. It's certainly true that there is a stepping stone across these systems. There's a part of the book discusses something called the school to prison pipeline, which is the name of a project run by New York Civil Liberties Union, and it's a term that's been adopted around the country now, about the ways in which the schools that serve the populations who are destined to go to prison, if the past is any predictor, and they're the same communities from which high rates of incarcerated fathers go to prison, that those boys are confronted day in and day out with challenges to their manhood, to their humanity. The people who used to be called school safety officers are now really policemen, frankly. Schools have metal detectors. All kinds of confrontations arise out of that. Challenging authority, which I've heard that teenage boys do even without drugs and guns. And so you take the normalities of development and you get them so wrong that you turn a system into a nursery for producing future prisoners. And many of them see it as their destiny. They used to be called the gladiatorial academies. You learn to fight. So you put a movie like Training Day, you know, these very lurid movies are the most accurate emotional portrayal of this world, just as the Marlon Brando movie about Vietnam. What was it called again?
Apocalypse Now.
That was the most accurate movie about the Vietnam War by everybody who ever was in that war. And it's a totally crazed, you know, piece. So the situation with children now of the children of the incarcerated, and that's a category that's now used, are just coming to be recognized for what they are. But from the numbers alone, in a place like the six neighborhoods in New York that feed the prison system, everybody sitting in a classroom in central Harlem or Bedford-Stuyvesant, everybody has an extended family network that's had multiple people in prison, have them now, will have them in the future, coming and going. Everyone in the class has this. Everyone knows about it. No one ever says a word about it. The stigma is so powerful, certainly in the communities that are most affected, because they have to defend themselves spiritually, you know, to say that we're not at blame for this. Like the Africans have to defend why they didn't create the AIDS epidemic, which they didn't. We did. Another story. But that situation is a very, very powerful one. And there's a piece missing, though, because the children of the groups that go to prison at high rates are not valued any more than the adults who are sent to prison. Because part of it is, someone raised the point before, Judge Sweet, I think, about other countries having different systems, and Ethan as well, having lower rates of incarceration. Without necessarily having lower rates of crime, except for the gun violence, which is unique to the United States, there's more of a sense of we, there's us, we're all one people in a lot of countries, especially small countries, where there's a kind of, not necessarily homogeneity, but the citizenship is taken seriously in a way that easily done away with. Ethan always used to talk about the drug exception to the Constitution, that if you are involved in drug use, the Constitution doesn't apply to you. You lose your personhood most powerfully by losing the right to vote. You're disenfranchised. You can't get loans for school. All the kinds of impediments that are piled on you because you've been arrested and in prison. That group is extremely hard to reintegrate into life. And so that has to become the target. How do you reintegrate former prisoners as they go back to the communities, families, and social networks they did? And that's why I look to the places that have had to deal with the most horrendous form of that kind of fragmentation, which is places where genocide has taken place. I don't think what's going on here is best described as genocide. I think it's oppressive. It's oppression of poor people, which the world knows a lot about, you know, independent of race. Mm-hmm. So, Marianne.
Thank you.
I just want to say about your state, Vermont. It's an interesting one in the national picture, because on the one hand, it's not among the top states when it comes to per capita incarceration. On the other hand, it's had the highest rate of increase in the prison population of all 50 states in the country. right?
We also have in the juvenile justice system, we're the highest state in the nation with kids on probation. Mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
When you think our population is only 600,000.
Well, the other thing is, you know, when you look at, for example, New York and New Jersey, which are leading the country in terms of reducing incarceration, they're also the two states which led the country in terms of incarceration for drug law violations 20 years ago. So New Jersey, in the early 1990s, was the only state in America, apart from Washington, D.C., where more than 50% of new commitments to state prison were for a drug law violation. And New York got over 40%. So it's possible that the states which went most overboard are the ones in the most position to kind of bring it down a bit, whereas a state like Vermont, which maybe did not, you know, kept going up. Now, the other promising thing is that your governor, Pete Shumlin, as the 50 governors go, at least in terms of what he spoke about in his early months, seems to be among the most outspokenly in favor of reform. I mean, he is strongly in favor of legal regulation of medical marijuana, standing up to the feds. He supports marijuana decrim.
Right.
He supports harm reduction.
Right.
And he's claimed that trying to do something about the prison population is a major priority. So there may be room for some innovative work in Vermont, although you're closer to it.
Well, what's peculiar is, you know, believe it or not, as a small state, we're pretty innovative. We've had diversion and restorative and reparative programs for the better part of 40 years. But what's interesting, as those programs have evolved and we've created, like, continuity of care services for youth reentering out of the juvenile system, the probation rate has gone up dramatically, and I don't know how you solve that one. That's what's been an amazing piece of it. In other words, you've got a model that's supposed to work and reincorporate offenders back into the community, and instead the probation rate has just soared, and I don't know the answer to that, but that's your next book, Ernie.
Well, I can say one thing about it, having worked up in Canada for a few years in British Columbia, with the Community Correction Service, actually. And I was astonished. I spent a weekend at a retreat with 500 probation workers, basically, from Canada. And watched them go through their conference, their professional conference. The professionalism of these people was dramatic. All of them had at least a bachelor's degree, and half of them had master's degrees in psychology and counseling. They were trained and supervised at a level which is superior to what I see in most mental health clinics in the United States. They had evidence-based practices, and they were held accountable to those. For them, the mark of success was keeping people from going back into prison. And the unit, the individuals in the units were held accountable around the recidivism rate.
Mm-hmm.
Same kind of people. There was there was spousal abuse. There was drug and alcohol. There was adolescent craziness. You know, the world's always the same. It's the same mix of people. And we have learned something about how to deal with these different problems that people have in life. And if you train the people who work with them to help them with them, rather than to punish them for them, and there were 500 workers in this little state of British Columbia with 2 million people who just did this. So I think the professionalism of that group is one of the keys. And I'm very optimistic about the outcomes if you have helpful, thoughtful people who are loyal to the kids with a goal of keeping them out of prison. And there's certainly such people exist in the system here. They get driven out pretty quickly.
Yeah. Our problem is an intergenerational lack of education and substance abuse. And next book.
Thank you.
Just to pick up on the issue of the children, one population we didn't mention, it may be small, and so this is really a comment, but today I think we're using the prison system as a surrogate for what we're not doing with education. In the state of Texas, so many of the young men there are diagnosed with ADHD or other intellectual and developmental disabilities. And if we don't treat these young people when they're younger, we do know they have a tendency to end up in the jails. So I'm an advocate for that community, so I just wanted to make that point. And then the other was the judge mentioned doing an economic study, and it would seem to me that as we privatize the jail system, there is an economic incentive to increase the number of those we incarcerate, because that leads to profits, right, once we privatize. So that's just a thought there on what the change in how we administer incarceration has changed by going to this for-profit, right, privatizing the jail. So it's just a comment. Also, we've worked together. We've never met. My name is Deborah. You've spoken to me. We've worked on a grant together, and I'm very happy to meet you. Yes, sir.
Oh, nice to meet you.
Deborah. Nice to meet you. Thank you.
We didn't get the grant.
on that, the role of privatizing prisons. You talk about it in your book, Dr. I'm sorry.
Do you want to say something about that?
No.
Go ahead. Go ahead if you had something to say.
Only a short conversation a few moments ago with Bobby Cohen, Dr. Cohen, and it just reflected what was just said, namely that the private institutions get paid by the day. And therefore, the longer they're in, the better the money.
Hi. So a couple of times while you've been talking, you've mentioned drug testing. And one of the big things that I learned about a whole bunch in my public health education was about the notion of false positives. And so I wanted to know if you felt comfortable talking to some of the issues regarding new technologies and the war on drugs and incarceration and some of the problems in terms of, especially as these new tools come out, we think we understand how to use them, but as wonderful as technology can be, for instance, I only know about this lecture because of the internet, there may be downsides and there may be unacknowledged problems, especially in the area of false positives.
I think that the technology side of it is way overblown. You can do perfectly good research in patterns of drug use by asking people what drugs they use and how much they use. And that'll be just as good as any urine testing or blood testing you could do, unless you put them in a situation where their answer controls whether they go to prison or not, in which case it's a different game. But if in situations where, then the fact is you're trying to get a piece of information not to use against the person rather than as part of a clinical picture where you ask people about drug use, they're always very forthcoming and very helpful if they really want help with their drug use. It's not been a problem in my experience clinically. I think the more serious part of this is the information technology. The record keeping and the ability of those records to find their way into every corner of the country and its life, such that you are never relieved of this thing, the criminal records I mentioned before. You know they have a program for keyboards that knows if your cat walks on the keyboard and turns it off? That's because they can look at the patterns of time, and I'm sure that you can discriminate the pattern of someone who smoked marijuana in putting in entry into a keyboard from someone who hasn't. I'm sure there's some guy who can figure that out in Los Alamos. Whatever your worst nightmare is about this thing, that's the one to think about in this case, because technology is not a friend of civil liberties. Huh? The cat was smoking marijuana? Anyway, it's a serious issue, but it's the information technology. It's serious. There's nothing new under the sun in drug testing.
Let me expand on what Ernie said and disagree a little bit, because I think what he's saying about the information technology and the computerized databases and the ways in which these, a youthful conviction for marijuana, 30 years ago may not show up, but if you have it today, it's going to show up for the rest of your life quite likely, and that even when court records are sealed, oftentimes they turn out not to be sealed because they land up in electronic databases that get exposed before these records are closed off. But I think where the technology side is getting even more interesting is on surveillance technology. And if you think about it, one way to think about this is to think of surveillance in terms of both internal surveillance and external surveillance. And internal surveillance relating to what people have inside their bodies, so basically drug testing. And those are areas where, we've been involved in legal actions, for example, challenging the reliability of hair testing. And there's racial because black sort of kind of kinky hair is more likely to retain it longer than white, there's elements there. So we've been able to challenge some of that stuff successfully. But to some extent, the problem of false positives is dramatically less than it was 20-odd years ago. It's more the use of the technology, that if you test positive for marijuana on a Monday, it doesn't mean that you were high at work, right? But then there's external surveillance. And that's really detecting where you are. And that's something where we see more and more support for that coming out of the war on terrorism, right? Where we see it coming out of the issues around illegal and legal immigration, and where we see it coming out basically in respect to alternatives to incarceration. And so you see, for example, now with the realignment in California or more broadly, that there's more and more of an impetus to sort of push towards getting people outside prison walls, but under the continuing supervision, right, of the supervisory criminal justice system. So I think it's quite possible that we could be moving towards a world where 10 years from now, we will have reduced the total number of people incarcerated to under 2 million people, but the number of people under the supervision of the criminal justice system will have gone from, what is it, 5.3 million now under parole and probation to maybe doubling that, right? And we will be expanding it to other sorts of populations. Understand also that more and more of this jives with what's happening in a voluntary basis. You know, now you have these little GPS devices. Put them on your pet, just in case they get lost. Put them on your, you know, grandparent or grandparent has Alzheimer's, just in case they get lost. Put it on your kids, so you know where they are, or your little kid, in case they get lost or kidnapped or whatever it might be. So there's a market for these things more and more, people wanting to have them and being less and less sensitive to issues around privacy. My great fear is that one can imagine a world in which we move towards a fusion of external and internal surveillance, in which our capacity to detect what people are consuming in the way of forbidden substances becomes ever more sophisticated, and our ability to detect where people are, not just through electronic bracelets, but GPS devices, becomes ever more sophisticated, and then in which they begin to become proactive. So imagine that when you're on parole or probation, not only are you being drug tested, or not only are you being, you know, have a GPS device, but imagine one that's more proactive. So that if, for example, you take a forbidden substance, alcohol or marijuana or cocaine or whatever, that your little GPS bracelet will release into your system a sort of antabuse or naloxone thing that will make you sick for taking it, even as it beeps the central control station that you have just violated these things. Or imagine something like that where you go more than 100 or 500 feet away from your home if you're under house arrest, not only will the message go out, but you'll receive a shock. And the shock will become of escalating pain the further you get away from this type of thing. Of course, there'll be occasional malfunction. Sorry, too bad. You know, you start getting shocked even when you're in the bathtub. But I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is that the technology is to some extent evolving where this sort of nightmare scenario I'm portraying is more and more technologically feasible even today. And what I see in the great push for alternatives to incarceration is many of us and allies sort of blindly embracing. You know, it's like we would embrace treatment instead of incarceration without asking what was actually meant by that treatment, right? And now we're embracing alternatives to incarceration in the community, in the home, without thinking what does it actually mean. On some level, anything has to be better than being locked up in a jail or a prison. But on the other hand, under what conditions and what does it mean? And I actually think that's one of the most important debates that needs to start happening, especially within the progressive criminal justice reform community, because they're at the forefront of pushing for these reforms without engaging these issues in a serious, substantive way.
Are there other questions?
Research on children of incarcerated parents dictates that, you know, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And so I'm wondering if you could just speak to that.
It's a real worry on the part of advocates because you're saying these children are little criminals because their parents were big criminals. And that's a very slippery slope. The reality is that the children of people who are incarcerated don't do as well. By every measure as the children who do. And one of the ways they don't do as well is the probability of their winding up in juvenile justice system and then going that being a stepping stone to prison. So the facts are pretty straightforward, the infant mortality data I mentioned. The question is, what's the intervention? And it seems the most obvious thing is the taking into account if there are children in a household of an adult who the system is contemplating incarcerating. Certainly a mother, and probably a lot of fathers, too. You know, what's the famous response from the cruel judge? Well, he should have thought of that before he did the crime. Well, the world doesn't work that way. People don't work that way. And you can feel sanctimonious about saying that and that it's his responsibility, not yours. But if you basically destroy the ability of that parent to be an effective parent, don't you, as a representative of the society, have to take some responsibility? And we know the foster care system isn't it. It's a big piece in the book about the termination of parental rights and the rules around that, which were designed to remove not just custody, but parental status of parents who go to prison for more than 18 months. Basically, the way the federal law is written, and the states enact this law in exchange for money for foster care programs, that if there's an 18-month absence of the child from the parent, the social workers involved with the child welfare agency are obligated to initiate proceedings for termination of parental rights. So a mother can be in prison 4 or 5 years, and all her children have been, she can't even know where they are in some cases. So and why wouldn't you, once you realize that your response to any crime is involving more than the perpetrator, it involves their family and dependent children for whom the community has some responsibility inevitably, it seems to me a very good place to start reforming the system, to insist that responsibility be recognized and exercised in a way to which the criminal justice system is held accountable. That's one of the problems, is the system isn't held accountable for all the consequences of its action. It can do all these things, it can do as much of it as it wants, and it doesn't have to defend that. And I think we have to change that so they do have to. And one of the ways you do that is to study it, publicize it, you know, scream it from the corners as much as possible. Everyone who's affected knows about it, but they don't count in this discussion.
Okay. Another question is, do you see incarceration as being a disease?
Yes. I consider it as a social response, a disease like racism that spreads through rumor and manipulates fear. It has that contagious quality to it. But it also has all these structural things associated with social networks. That's been my lesson I've learned in the last 10 years as I've studied social networks, is how powerful they are. The most important thing you need to know about social networks is the big get bigger, the rich get richer, the fat get fatter. Social networks are like gravity. They suck they suck people and institutions into them, and they assume power in that way, not because anyone's intending it to be that way. This happens not just for human institutions, it happens for animal groups, it happens for funguses, for God's sake. This is one of the fundamental laws of nature, apparently, that scale draws things into it and perpetuates itself. And that's another way of thinking about transmission across generations, for example, as opposed to I infect you with my virus, which is a different kind of transmission.
And the last question would be, so how do you get bit, quote unquote? Like, how does this disease get passed on?
Oh, you get put in prison.
Okay.
Okay, that's the case that starts it. I worked in occupational health for years with asbestos workers. And they went to a factory and they work with asbestos and they came home and gave asbestos to their kids who got cancer. You know, it's a toxic exposure. And the more severe the punishment, the most severe being solitary, extended isolation. Wonderful article at Talagawanda about the way in which isolation emulates the effects of traumatic brain injury. Very, very important set of findings. No one's responsible. No one. You know, the supermax prisons, Jamie Fellner's away, she'd be here, and others from Human Rights Watch have done this work on chronicling the use of isolation. We have 4% of the world's population, 25% of its prisoners, and 55% of those in isolation in the entire world. You know, so that's target things like that harm individuals, target things that harm the children, and say the system of the criminal justice system, its tension is not to harm citizens, it's to protect citizens, including the ones who are inside.
Thank you.
Are there other questions? Do you have anything else to say? Do you want to wrap up, Ernie?
My response to this session is, I think, one word, responsibility. And I think as a society, we have to be responsible for, we must get the society to be responsible for what it has done.
And in that way, it's no different than environmental change, climate change, you know, all these big things going on that you can't wrap your head around so easily, but they are going on. And the longer we put off dealing with them, the worse it will be. And, you know, and this in this current insanity of punitiveness that's going on in this country, the Tea Party and cheering the executions in Texas, you know, that sends a chill down my spine. And I think we have to pay attention to that response very seriously, as we would have paid attention had we been in Germany in 1932. I hope.
Thanks very much. Thanks, our panelists.